Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. Technically, we're starting our third year, but I guess this will be called our second anniversary show. Welcome, Tim.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, Tim, do you think you think we'd make it to 3 years on this?
To be honest, I had no idea. I still remember thinking when you came up with this idea and approached me with it, I thought, okay, he's gone crazy. He's gone around the bend. But here we are.
Yeah,
here we are.
Exceeded expectations, maybe. And then Catherine's not going to be here, so we thought we'd have somebody sit in that has sat in many times before but was also on the very first show. Welcome, Scott Aikman.
Good evening. How are you?
Oh, good to have you back, Scott. Going to talk a little bit all kind of southern topics. Also, later in the evening, or just here in a minute, actually, Tom Jensen of Public Policy Poland, one of our favorite guests, is going to come on, and they have been doing, once again, as much polling, if not more, than most of your polling firms nationally with a variety of states and a national poll, because I guess it's never too easy, or never too early to start looking at 2012. So all that'll be good talk. But I tell you, first thing I want to talk about before Tom comes on was yesterday on the blogs, if you're reading Tondi's Tavern, we found out that John Flack has decided he's going to leave Tondi's Tavern for personal / professional reasons. And I just wanted to wish John the best. If that's the right decision for him, it's the right decision for I'm behind him, I'll say. And I wanted to thank him because, I mean, he's always been good about promoting the Kudzu Vine, been on at different times. Actually, our intro music, John Flack created. So there's a lot of ways the Kudzu Vine owes a thanks to John Flack. Tim, what was your thought on him deciding to hang it up?
Oh, well, it was kind of stunning news. I mean, you get used to turning over and seeing the Flack attack, you know, and He told you he had an announcement coming up. He definitely was not kidding.
Yes, but I think the good news is he started a lot of those things, including the latest thing he started is the Tondi's Tavern Fund. So he set a lot in motion, so hopefully other folks can pick it up. And I know folks like Ed Hula over there will probably continue doing what they do. Scott, what's your thought on John leaving?
You know, sometimes folks think there are greener pastures on the other side of the fence. So,
I don't think he's switching party votes by any means. I think he's just saying professionally he's got some responsibilities. And I know, I mean, he like you and I both, Scott, he has a family with kids in the home. And I've seen that where a lot of times people want to get involved, you know, super deeply in politics, but family demands just take over at times. I'm sure you've seen that, Scott, right?
Absolutely. Firsthand. I wasn't implying that he was switching parties. I'm just talking about, you know, you got to sometimes change direction in life, and sometimes it means, you know, stepping back.
Yeah, and about the other side, you meant political, non-political, not left, right, blue, red, Democratic, Republican. I just know I have to clarify for folks. You never know. People might think we're accusing somebody of something else, so we just have to be super clear. But, so that's something that's going to be interesting to see what happens out of that because, obviously, you know, the four main blog sources in Georgia politics, Tondi's Tavern, Blog for Democracy, the AJC with Jim Galloway, which that's kind of different in that it's a paid reporter to do it. But, I mean, he breaks a lot of stuff here. And then Peach Pundit, who, even though they try to say it's neutral or bipartisan, it certainly takes more of a Republican slant. But, I mean, now there are times like when they calculate the GOP straw polls. I mean, they're the best source in the state, so I'm not going to, you know, poo-poo everything they do because there's certain things they're the best at. Well, I think we're ready to welcome Tom Jensen on from Public Policy Polling. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks for having me. Congratulations on your anniversary.
Oh, yes. Well, we wanted to book a great guest, and you've always been a great guest in the past. And we were saying before you got on, such a busy polling firm is yours. And so what better guest to have on, because y'all have more information, more data, it seems like, than anybody else.
We try to stay busy.
Yes. Well, one thing I noticed is that y'all are looking ahead to 2012 already, even though it's just the first 100 days of Barack Obama. I noticed you polled four candidates, and the one that came out the best was Mike Huckabee. Why do you think Mike Huckabee fared better than some of the other candidates?
Well, I think he does better than Newt Gingrich and Sarah Palin, because Gingrich and Palin are both just such polarizing figures that they get very little support from independents, very little support from Democrats. And then Mitt Romney has a lot of skepticism about him, even within his own party, a lot of Republicans who wouldn't be particularly enthusiastic about voting for him. So it's almost like Huckabee is just the least offensive of the quartet of Republicans being mentioned most prominently for 2012.
Yes, and I guess it's kind of tricky in that you have to poll somebody against Barack Obama that has some semblance of name ID, even though a profile like a Charlie Crist, a moderate Republican governor, might do better. A lot of folks would be like, I have no idea who that is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is something that we're planning to do monthly as we move forward. And we'll certainly, you know, swap some Republicans in as they become more prominent on the national scene if they really look like they're going to be candidates, and then we'll swap some out. And we certainly know it's way too early to be looking at this kind of thing, but folks are interested, and it gives us something to sort of look back at over time and track and see how things changed.
Yes, I mean, I guess will Sarah Palin fade, being that she's not a part of the continental United States, several time zones away? what happens there is we'll forget her. One state that's been very interesting, and even though we're a southern show, it's not a southern state, but it's just too interesting, I think, the numbers coming out of there, and that's Colorado. I mean, that's a state that trended so blue this year. I was reading Chuck Todd's book, How Barack Obama Won, and it talked about how Colorado trended so fast, you could see it coming, and then it just went all the way blue, and you have Ritter, the governor, both senators are Democrats now, all these different things. But then the numbers are not good for the Democratic Party on really any of the races.
It's interesting. Every single state where there was a gubernatorial appointment of a new senator, both the governor who did the appointing and the senator who got appointed are in pretty bad shape right now. And Colorado fits that pattern. And, you know, one of the things that's been so key to that state becoming so Democratic is the expanding Hispanic vote, and it going 2-1 for Democrats. But when you had Ken Salazar, the state's first Hispanic senator, appointed as Barack Obama's Secretary of Interior, and then the governor did not appoint a Latino replacement, Hispanic voters are taking that both out on Governor Bill Ritter and also on his appointee, Senator Michael Bennett. So there's a lot of sort of inter-party healing that it looks like there is to do over the next 18 months. I wouldn't start threaten a whole lot if I was Bill Ritter or Michael Bennett, but their numbers definitely leave a lot to be desired at this point.
Yes, and you mentioned, you know, appointed candidates and the governors that appointed them. Now, from an outside observer, the Colorado process seemed to be, you know, much smoother than, say, the New York process and certainly the Illinois process. Well, what about that are people reacting negatively to?
Well, It definitely was the cleanest on paper, but the number one thing is Hispanic voters thinking that a Hispanic should have been appointed. So that's part of the problem. But then the other thing was that, you know, we took a poll in Colorado right after Salazar got his new job and asked people who they thought should be appointed. And Michael Bennett didn't even register in that. Most folks wanted the mayor of Denver, John Hickenlooper, to be appointed, and then in second place was John Salazar, a congressman who's the former senator's brother. So Ritter really went against public opinion in appointing Bennett, you know, who's basically a blank slate. So I think that might be part of the problem. And you see sort of the same thing in New York, where David Paterson appointed a relatively obscure member of Congress in Kirsten Gillibrand, and you see both of their numbers sort of tanking right now, too. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Colorado definitely was the cleanest, but folks there still don't seem to have been real thrilled with how it went down.
Yes. Now look at the national rating. Barack Obama's approval rating has, you know, stayed very strong nationally, but in Colorado, for states that he won, has been less than that. Why do you think that is?
Well, what's interesting about Colorado is that of the states that we poll really regularly, it's the most evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans of all of those states. And the reason it's gone so Democratic in the last two or three elections is because the independent voters in the state have been really voting overwhelmingly Democratic. We had Obama winning independents by 24 points last year in Colorado, Senator Mark Udall winning them by 27. But the independents don't seem to be as enamored right now with the Democrats in Colorado as they were at the ballot box in the last two polls, in the last two elections. And we've actually found President Obama with some sort of iffy approval numbers among independents almost everywhere that we've been polling. I mean, he's certainly doing a very good job of keeping Democrats happy with him. But independents are more split, and they split pretty much evenly on this poll in Colorado, and that's why his numbers weren't quite as good as they've been in some other states and on a national basis.
Yes. Well, I'm going to pass the question and over to Scott Aikman so he can ask you about some different southern state polls you've done.
Sure.
I was just curious, having been born in Kentucky, your thoughts about what was going on with the Bunning race or the potentials there as they unwind in that state.
Sure. Jim Bunning is absolutely toast. We did a poll in Kentucky in early April. Bunning had a 28% approval rating. We tested him against all four Democrats being discussed as possible opponents. Attorney General Jack Conway and Lieutenant Governor Dan Mangiardo are already in the race. They were both leading Bunning. It seems less likely now that those two are in that Congressman Ben Chandler or State Auditor Crit Llewellyn will join in as well, but they were beating Bunning too. But what was interesting was we also tested Republican Secretary of State Trey Grayson, who would probably be the Republican candidate if Bunning actually stepped down. And when you put Grayson in the mix, he was within the margin of error against all four of those Democrats. He was leading a couple of them, and he was trailing a couple of them, but it was very close. So there's no doubt that Republicans would be much better off if Trey Grayson was their nominee next year. But Bunning is, you know, being stubborn, as has been his wont. And right now, I think if he stays in it, this is going to go Democratic.
So the state itself is not really, if you will, moving towards the Democrats so much as it is moving against Bunning.
Yeah, it's definitely all about Bunning. I think that if Bunning retired, you'd still have a more competitive Senate race in Kentucky than you've had since Bunning got elected in 1998. He won by less than half a point when he was first elected. So I think you'd certainly have a competitive race, but I think the Democrats would be more than happy for Bunning to really stick to it and run for reelection.
And in terms of the U.S. Senate and its leadership, you know, Mitch McConnell there of Kentucky, very high up the ladder. Is he pushing Bunning out, or is he trying to, if you will, save an old friend some grace and cover for him? Or what's the deal between those two on a personal basis?
Well, they definitely don't like each other. Bunning hates McConnell's guts. Publicly, McConnell says that, you know, if Bunning wants to run, that he's supportive. But Bunning doesn't believe McConnell. Bunning has actually gone right out in public and said that he doesn't trust him at all, that he doesn't believe a word he says. So I still would not be shocked, as much as Mitch McConnell has said that he will not recruit somebody to run in the primary against Bunning, I still wouldn't be shocked if that really does end up happening. And if Republicans just think they have no chance if Bunning stays in, I wouldn't be surprised if McConnell gets somebody else to run. So, you know, Bunning says he doesn't trust McConnell, and I'm not entirely sure that Bunning is not correct to distrust McConnell.
Well, I'm certain then that the Courier-Journal and the other major newspapers there in the state want Bunning to stay in the race. And I mean, it sounds like it has all the ingredients of some of the old faces of the 60s and 70s. Maybe things will unwind in favor of the Democrats, but we'll see. In terms of what's going on in Arkansas, is Blanche Lincoln in serious trouble, or are the Republicans attempting to build a bench?
Yeah, I don't think – Blanche Lincoln is not that popular, but she's also not in that much trouble. She has a 45% approval rating with 40% disapproving, so that's not real great. But the fact of the matter is that Lincoln has not been one of these senators who is hugely popular and gets elected and reelected by enormous margins every time. I think she got 54 to 56% of the vote. Both in 1998 when she was first elected and in 2004 when she is reelected. Neither of those times did she have a particularly strong Republican opponent. It's not like she was running against folks who had served in statewide office or really were well-known or anything. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that Republicans don't have a very good bench in Arkansas, and unless Mike Huckabee just sort of randomly decided to run for the Senate instead of running for president in 2012, they just don't have that strong of a candidate. So, I mean, it's going to be one of those races that they put some effort into, but I imagine that Lincoln wins with 55, 56% of the vote, just like she has the previous two times.
Of those Republicans, though, that are potential candidates, who would you consider to be the strongest? And let's exclude Huckabee, who may entertain the thought of rounding out his legislative resume.
I think the strongest candidate probably against Lincoln would be Tim Griffin, the former U.S. attorney in the state, mostly because he is somebody who really has the strong backing of Karl Rove, which I think pretty much guarantees that there'd be some strong financial backing there, that they'd really put some money behind him. But, you know, again, close ties to the Bush administration aren't even going to fly well in Arkansas. So it's going to be tough for Arkansas Republicans to get a candidate who can beat Lincoln.
Okay. So I guess that's all I have. Other than it's too sad for Ben Chandler that his granddaddy Happy can't campaign for him.
Yes. Well, Tim, I know you're going to ask about probably the hottest race in the nation, Virginia, among other things.
Yes, sir, I am, as a matter of fact. Good evening, Mr. Jensen. I'd like to come south now and start in a state where we're having an election this year, and that is the state of Virginia. Now, your polling has been showing that the GOP could win this governor's race this year, and I was wondering if you could tell us what dynamics are driving that race.
Well, I think the two – I definitely think, you know, if you had to pick a favorite right now, it would be Bob McDonnell, the presumptive Republican nominee. And I think there's two reasons for that at this point. Number one is that McDonnell, as the state's attorney general, is just much better known than any of the Democrats running. Brian Moran and Cree Deeds have both been, have been elected officials, but only at the local level. As representatives in the legislature, and then Terry McAuliffe, of course, is so well-known nationally, but, not necessarily well-known in Virginia at all. So I think, number one, you start out with a big name recognition advantage for McDonnell, and then number two is this Democratic primary is probably going to get pretty ugly, and it's already been a little ugly sort of below the surface. It's a big question if Terry McAuliffe wins the Democratic nomination, how enthusiastic some of Brian Moran and Cree Deeds' supporters are going to be about going for him in the general election. So I think a big key for Democrats in Virginia, you know, somebody's probably going to win this primary with 40% of the vote. I mean, it's going to be a very closely contested three-way primary. And the question then is how well are Democrats going to be able to all get on the same page? At this time last year, a lot of folks thought Democrats were in trouble because they never thought that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton could get on the same page, and they did. And that's going to need to be a model for Democrats in Virginia if they're going to win this fall.
Yeah, but with Governor Kaine being from Virginia, the GOP literally has to be licking their chops at the prospect of picking this one off, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely going to be the most exciting race in the country this fall, I think. And, you know, the GOP, especially after losing two straight gubernatorial elections in Virginia, everybody expected the last time the Republican Attorney General was the nominee in 2005, Jerry Kilgore, everybody expected him to win the governorship for most of 2005, and then Tim Kaine came back at the end and ended up pulling off a somewhat surprising victory. So the stakes are very high. I mean, this is a race that everybody's going to be looking to as a harbinger for what's going to happen in 2012. Virginia, along with a state like Colorado, is one of these places that 5 or 6 years ago we probably would have thought of it as a red state, but now it's really been trending blue. And it's the kind of place where Republicans are going to have to win if they're going to get their party headed back in a winning direction after the 2006 and 2008 election cycle. So I think it's going to be quite a show.
Speaking of states in the South, now this one, frankly, has me scratching my head. The Democrats had not won in North Carolina since Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see that Liddy Dole has lost. We see that Barack Obama won. Now your polling is showing Senator Burr is in trouble. And I just got to ask, what in the world is going on in that state?
What has happened to both Senator Burr and Senator Dole is that they just have not done a good job of showing the people of North Carolina that they're accomplishing anything for them in Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, Liddy Dole certainly had the she's not one of us sort of construct. She had 1 year that she only spent 13 days in the state while she was representing the state in the Senate. Burr doesn't quite have that problem. But people don't know who he is. I mean, we find that even after more than 4 years in the Senate, more than a third of voters in the state have never even heard of him. So, you know, it's not that they have been having corruption scandals or that they've done anything particularly wrong. They just haven't done a good job of really making a strong impression with the voters. So, and then, you know, we have North Carolina never should have been as Republican as it was, but the Democratic Party gave up on it too easily in some election cycles. And then last fall when they didn't give up on it, we saw that if the effort was really put into turning out the African-American vote, that combined with the fact that, you know, we're one of the fastest growing states in the country and the folks moving here are more likely to be Democrats than the older folks, or at least more likely to be the sort of Democrats who vote for Democratic presidential candidates, it makes a big difference. So I think Richard Burr, along with Jim Bunning, are the two most vulnerable Republican incumbents in the country planning to run for re-election.
So if you want to put North Carolina in a category, would you put it blue, red, or purple?
Purple, but trending blue. The baseline indicators are definitely pointing in a Democratic direction. Two big reasons. Number one is North Carolina had the second largest disparity of any state in the country between how voters under 30 went for president last year and voters over 65. Voters
wow.
under 30 went for Obama by 48. Voters over 65 went for McCain by 13.
Wow.
Obviously, those voters under 30 are going to be going up in the population while the voters over 65 go down, so that's a big thing. And then the Hispanic vote is exploding in the state, and it hasn't necessarily become a huge factor yet, but it's going to be moving forward. We have eight times as many Hispanic registered voters now as we did just 5 years ago, and that trend's going to continue. And if they continue to vote 2-1 Democratic like they did this last fall, I think that you're certainly not going to have an election cycle again anytime soon like 2004. Where the Kerry campaign just packed up and went home in early September and said, forget about North Carolina.
Wow, that is interesting stuff. David, back to you, sir.
Yes. Well, Tom, we could keep you all night and ask you questions because you bring so much information. We know you got people to see and things to do. But before we let you go, I wanted to find out what kind of polls might you have in the planning stages that will be released soon?
Well, what we'll be releasing this week is a poll in Illinois, and I can just, you know, go ahead and tell you, not that this is surprising, Roland Burris is not going to be returning to the U.S. Senate when it reconvenes in 2011. Basically, any Democrat who runs against him is going to be successful. And then of particular interest to you all is in a couple weeks we're going to do a comprehensive Georgia poll. I think that Johnny Isaacson is the most vulnerable senator in the country next year that nobody's talking about. We did a poll in the state in November where he only had a 30% approval rating, and it was the same sort of thing as Richard Burr. It wasn't that so many people disliked him, but 45% of voters in the state at that time said, we have no clue. And Democrats need to not make the same mistake they made in Georgia last year, which was to realize way too late what a great opportunity they had to beat Saxby Chambliss. And then Jim Martin was an okay candidate. He did an okay job, but probably not the best candidate Democrats could have gotten if they had realized just how big of an opportunity they had. So we're going to do that poll in a couple weeks. And you know, maybe it turns out Johnny Isaacson is more popular than we thought, but if he's not, that's a race that needs to really get on folks' radar.
Yes, I mean, the thing is I haven't heard anyone put serious interest into that race yet on the Democratic side, so that's one thing I'll be interested to see what names you find to put up. I guess obviously you could put up people that have not said they're interested but are known commodities in Georgia. But
I'm not Kathy Cox.
Well, we're going to talk about that later, but Kathy Cox was quoted in the paper as saying she is very happy in the world of academia. Zero chance of a comeback is what it said in the AJC, but I think that's a great name to test, at least for a Democratic baseline, because she's obviously very popular with Democrats and middle-of-the-road independents.
Absolutely. And we'll probably look at, you know, like Roy Barnes, even though if he's interested in anything, he's interested in running for governor, we'd like to show people what the opportunities are.
Oh, certainly. Well, that's why y'all do such a great job. Y'all ask a lot more questions. I mean, we have some firms that will ask three questions in a poll. Y'all's is comprehensive, as you said, and people can tell exactly what's in those questions.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, Tom, thanks again for all your time and your information.
Thank you all.
No, thank you very much.
Good night, sir.
Yes. Well, it was great having Tom on this second anniversary show, but I'll go ahead and tell you, since he brought it up, let's talk about it. Kathy Cox, this was on Monday. It probably was printed online about the same time we were going off the air. In their Where Are They Now feature in the AJC, they talked about Kathy Cox, and I kind of thought everybody kind of knew she was running Young Harris, but she said there is zero chance of her making a comeback. Scott, you're in the world of academia and higher education. What do you think so appealing to Kathy in about that world?
Well, you know, academic freedom is very liberating in terms of if you're a classroom teacher. You know, maybe she likes a constituency of 18 to 25-year-olds better than 18 to, you know, whoever makes it out to the polls. You know, I hate that she's not interested because I think she's a vital asset to the Democratic Party as a whole in the state. She's certainly a viable candidate, I would think. But, you know, as an academic, I tell you what, I wouldn't go into politics for nothing.
Well, Tim, what's your thoughts on Kathy Cox?
Well, you know, she had been in politics just about all her life, first with her father and then with herself. David, some people do get burnout, but I do want to remind you of something that you and Scott are not old enough to remember this, but I certainly do. In 1962, when Richard Nixon ran for governor of California and he got lost, or he lost, and he told the reporters, okay, you guys are not going to have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. And 6 years later, he was elected president, as we know. So, you know, I've heard too many politicians leave office and say never again. So I'm not going to go quite that far.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one thing. I really think she is very happy and content and doesn't see a compelling need to come back. But I'll tell you this, if you said I had to start a draft movement of a Georgia politician that's currently not trying to run for something, I mean, Kathy Cox would be at the top of my list. I mean, I think
well, if you
want incredible
if you want to take a ride up the young Harris, I'll definitely ride with you. Let's put it that way.
Yes, I've been to Young Harris. That was the other college I visited besides Shorter. I mean, I'll go ahead and say this, and Scott, that may get me in trouble in some circles, but it's a college campus. I liked it every bit as well, Shorter, if not better. I just like the city of Rome better than the city of Young Harris. So I do think it's a nice place to be and in the mountains. And if you're not looking for a vibrant social life, which a married lady like Kathy Cox is not, then Young Harris is probably a great place to, you know, live and work each day. Well, I guess on other topics, the Georgia governor's race, you know, there's still new news. Tim and I talk about it seemingly every week with Catherine on the show, but there's still more things going on. We found out that Lynn Westmoreland's not in, Eric Johnson may be in, Roy Barnes, there's more polling showing that if he wants to get in, it's his nomination at least to lose. But Scott, since you're a fresh voice on this, what's your take on the Georgia governor's race?
Well, you know, I'm kind of wanting to see who's not going to enter that so we can see who's going to run for senator. you know, it seems like everybody and their brother wants to run for governor, at least thus far. And to be honest with you, I think, you know, the field thus far is a pretty competent one. I don't really necessarily think that anyone should be excluded from entering, but, I mean, why couldn't Roy run for the U.S. Senate? But, you know. I will say this, I have the utmost respect for Governor Barnes. I mean, he did something in his first term that a lot of folks would have waited till their second term when they were lame to do. So in terms of his, you know, political courage, he certainly is a tough candidate to disqualify. But, you know, whether you're looking at one side of the fence or the other, there's a lot of heavyweights out there. And thus entering that race, they've opened up a lot of other positions. You know, one of the supposed gubernatorial candidates for the Republicans out of Cobb County is not going to seek the governorship, but instead he's going to seek Thurbert Baker's soon-to-be-vacated job if he becomes governor or fails. So I'm curious to see not just who's running for governor, but who's going to fill in these other slots down ticket.
Yes, Lieutenant Governor's won the Democratic Party. Other than Tim Golden, who hadn't announced, that's the only name I've even heard rumored about for Lieutenant Governor. But, you know, like I said, we had some polls. We did have Lynn Westmoreland stay, and he wants to stay in the House, Tim. But we did have Eric Johnson saying that he's going to give another look at the governor's race, or at least for saying he will. What's your thoughts on the happenings of this week in the Georgia governor's race?
Well, I think now, David, you're going to see a lot of Republicans who were shying away from that race saying they're going to give it a second look. Love him or hate him, the exit of Casey Cagle has shaken up the governor's race. He was the favorite to be elected the next governor. He was certainly the favorite over on the Republican side. And so there are several Republican heavyweights that are going to look at that. And on the Democratic side, things just keep changing, especially with Roy Barnes. He's going to run. He's not going to run. He's going to run. He's not going to run. Now I'm of the opinion that, yes, he is going to run because I've, you know, heard a few things.
Well, I mean, if you look at the poll, it says that he's the leading candidate. And I forgot which, but I think it was Strategic Vision put out the poll this week. I mean, it showed him leading. If he's not in the race, Thurbert Baker leads him. I do think that's a runoff situation. If this moment in time, those four candidates get on the ballot, it looks like it would be Barnes and Baker in a runoff and then going from there. And then, of course, if the other nominee is John Oxendine, you couldn't ask for probably a better Republican opponent because I just don't see Governor Oxendine in the state's future.
Therefore, if you don't see that, don't you think a guy like Eric Johnson doesn't see that either?
Yeah, I mean, can the guy win the nomination? Maybe so. I mean, he's just a weaker candidate. I don't know what the Republican Party will think. I mean, I just don't see him as being the ideologue either that just takes that nomination home. If he doesn't have electability and he doesn't, you know, fit lockstep with a more conservative wing of their party, I don't know that he can't be taken for the nomination. I think
Eric Johnson's banking real hard on that 7% of the flag vote. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's what he gets so far. I don't know. Obviously, another thing is, and this is probably one of Dubose Porter's strong suits, he's the only candidate not from Metro Atlanta in the Democratic side, even though I think David Poitras does have some non-Metro roots. I believe he resides down in Gwinnett County. So that gives him something. I know on the Republican side, you have Austin Scott, who, you know, people just aren't taking that seriously at this point. So I guess Eric Johnson could see him having a little, you know, a different geographic base to go from. So that's something to look at. And then, of course, Casey Cagle, he did have his back surgery. I mean, is there a chance that the back surgery goes so well that Casey Cagle jumps back in the race? Any odds on that, Tim?
You know, I'm sorry. I didn't drink the Kool-Aid, okay? I mean, when like I said last week, okay, the guy's back hurt him bad enough that he can't run for governor, but, hey, his back will be fine for him to run for lieutenant governor. I'm sorry. It don't wash. Buzz, if you're listening, I'm really starting to believe your story.
Yeah, well, I will say this. The fundraising may be a bit bigger portion of it, too. If he didn't think he could recover from his back surgery and do his telephone time, he'll have the money to run for lieutenant governor, being the incumbent, but he couldn't raise the money then he would need for governor, and that may be part of it because I do think those are different races, but I do think there's something more there, too. But
I will say
that probably washes.
It walks like a duck and quacks like a duck.
Yeah. There we go.
I mean, yeah, that would have been like Hillary Clinton saying, you know what, I'm not going to run for president because – although she didn't end up with the nomination, nor did she win the presidency, she was the pre-crowned victor of that presidential campaign. And let's be honest, Casey Cagle was the pre-crowned victor of the governor's race.
Right.
It's wide
right.
open. It's a turkey shoot right now.
Yeah, but there are no Barack Obamas in that field or Republicans.
No, I'm not saying there is, but I'm saying if you're the golden child, if you're the front runner, why do you walk away until at least the primary?
I guess go ahead and save himself for, you know, 216. Actually, got my years wrong. 214, maybe even 220. I think. I mean, 214, especially if he retains the lieutenant governorship, the Democratic Party wins, then of course he could be right there to run to get the office back, if you will. Although Georgians don't seem to turn out incumbent governors, as has happened basically one time in our state's history, that being 2002.
This is going to be odd.
So you're suggesting that he wants to break the record that was held by the lieutenant governor that served under Joe Frank and Zell?
Sometimes you see if you wait it out, good things can happen. Think if Mark Taylor or Kathy Cox would have waited this last time out, they would have been sitting perfectly to run this time, and probably you wouldn't see four people in the primary. I mean, it would be a much cleaner shot.
I want to throw something else in that's going to surprise you a little bit. I'm sorry Casey Cagle got out of this race in a way, and I'm going to tell you why. It would be most unfortunate for the people of Georgia if Karen Handel were to somehow become the governor.
Yeah, I mean,
very, very unfortunate.
Yeah, pick your poison, Tim. Arsenic, mercury. I mean, there's, you know, it's all.
Yeah, really.
I understand what Tim's saying, but you know what? It cuts the other way as well. I'd much rather personally wake up with Handel as governor than Oxendine.
Pick your poison. I just don't know. Well, let's go ahead and move to another state real quick. The Jackson mayor's race, which is, you know, we're talking, you know, 9 days out, and it's gotten real interesting over there. Of course, we've talked about Frank Melton, the incumbent mayor, and his escapades. They still haven't sorted out his residency situation, but they had the, you know, probably the biggest debate of the campaign, and there's like 14 candidates running. I mean, it's a double-digit number of Democrats, 10, and a few Republicans and independents. But they had their biggest debate, and Melton did not even show up for the debate. And yet it still kind of turned a little fiery because I think a lot of folks no longer see Frank Melton as the front runner anyway. So usually in these multi-candidate debates, the front runner is the one they go after. Tim, your thought on that?
Well, they certainly did, too. They went after, wouldn't you know, a guest that we have had on this very show. The polling is now showing that Marchand Crisler is the front runner down there. And considering the fact that how he was attacked, he's obviously the candidate to beat in that race. I don't know what the incumbent mayor is thinking about, not even showing up for this debate and having what he termed a fundraiser at a local hotel. What, a few days before the election, the incumbent mayor, who probably has a huge war chest, is having a fundraiser? Oh, come on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because obviously everybody 9 days or 11 days when it happened out from election holds a fundraiser and chooses not to be on a televised debate.
Yeah,
that
right.
Makes absolutely no sense. By the way, Friday night debates, when did that make any sense either? Especially for a local race. I thought that was kind of crazy, but it would get the coverage the next day in the paper, which it did. It was the front page of the Jackson paper. And incidentally, the Metro section, it was Marchand Crisler's day to be featured in that race the same day, so that coincided real well for him. Well, Tim, something we haven't had for a few weeks, but it seems just totally fitting on our anniversary show to go ahead and have another one of your great outrages of the week.
Well, let's talk about tea parties and such. David, you know something, you just got to love these Republicans and what I would call their selective amnesia. You see, by conveniently forgetting some things, they can conjure other things. Like, for instance, nothing is ever their fault. The Democrats are the scum of the earth while they are both sinless and blameless. Plus, with selective amnesia, they can pretend to be opposing one thing while in reality they oppose another. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, that provided the perfect backdrop for these little gatherings around the country recently known as tea parties. Set on Tax Day, April 15th, the organizers of these events portrayed them as, quote, grassroots protests against the out-of-touch federal government and its out-of-control spending and taxation. Hey, we even had one locally, guys, right down there with you in Rome, and this event had it all. They had people dressed up like Revolutionary War patriots, and they had ladies dressed up like Indians who actually threw tea into the Oostenaula River. And they had a country band who played I'm Proud to Be an American. And I'm here to tell you guys, no tea party is complete without one of those, okay? And they had people who wore tea bags like earrings and proclaimed themselves tea baggers. Now, they did live to regret that one, by the way, because comedians do not miss anything. And finally, they had one more thing. They had a little program. It was emceed by the chairman of the county Republican Party. It featured 12 speakers, all of them on the dais that were elected officials were Republican. One of the speakers even had the nerve to report that all local Democratic officials were invited and that none showed up. Well, that's a lie. I wasn't invited, neither was any elected official that I have spoken to about it. I wish I had been invited, by the way, but I don't think they would have liked what I would have said to them. Now, there were about 700 of these tea parties scattered around the country. About 300,000 people altogether attended them. By far, most of the attendees were in the South. For instance, there were more people at the Rome, Georgia Tea Party than there were at the Baltimore, Maryland Tea Party. There were more than twice the attendees in Atlanta than in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Milwaukee combined. And then there was Texas, a republic unto itself. Governor Rick Perry seized the day when he hinted that perhaps Texas should secede from the Union. Of course, what he did not mention was that he's running for re-election and he's in trouble. Now, that's where his outrage really lays, in polling numbers. I find it interesting that the Republicans had these anti-tax rallies when 95% of the workforce in this country just got a tax cut. Or are they mad because the 5% richest didn't? Now, that could be because I never saw any tea parties when the richest Americans were getting big tax cuts and the rest of us got nothing. And I find it interesting that we are being lectured about spending. The last president, George Bush, almost doubled the national debt in 8 years. He did what it took the previous 41 presidents over 200 years to do. He inherited an economy with a budget surplus and ran it into a near depression. And wouldn't you know it, no tea parties in any of those 8 years that he was president. I'm sure that was just an oversight, though, right? So let's get to the real reason for these tea parties. They were organized on a national basis by someone called Freedom Works. That happens to be Dick Armey's conservative lobbying group. And they were heavily promoted by Fox News, who even provided some of their stars like Sean Hannity to bump attendance at some of these rallies. And they had one theme that drove them all. Now, listen carefully. Here it is. Here's the big secret. Barack Obama got elected president. And you know what? They just can't stand it. Here is their worst nightmare, a liberal Democrat in the White House, and he's actually acting like a liberal Democrat. And he has a Democratic Congress with him. So suddenly the Republicans are not very relevant in Washington anymore. I guess the Tea Parties are part of their attempt to be relevant. But what they are instead are cartoonish, straight off the drawing easel of something akin to Dr. Seuss. They wave American flags while screaming secede. They promote yesterday's voices like Newt Gingrich as your voice for the future. They run under-talented people like Sarah Palin for national high office. Their ideas are frozen in the 1980s. And the American people have thrown them, their old ideas, and their leaders out on the street. Hey, they're sore losers, and they're not going to take it anymore, right? You know, I've never been a fan of the Republican Party. That's no big secret. But I must admit that the Republican Party has really seen better days. And it could again. Come on, Republicans. You're better than this. Or you can continue on this insane path of yours and go the way of the Whigs. That's your call, not mine. I suppose, though, that there is a niche for a party that wants to be no more than, I don't know, the party of talk radio. Because right now, that's what the Republicans and their little teabag battalions are. But do me one small favor, Republicans. Please, please, please refrain from comparing yourself to the Patriots of Boston long ago. That is simply outrageous, David.
Tim, it's like you've been listening to Game On. Desmond and I talked about this last week, and really how the Republicans seem to be shrinking their party by just going to the hard right, and it's not going to grow their party. It's kind of like this Chavez thing they latched onto. I will say this, talking about Georgia, they did have the largest Tea Party, but the star that came out of that event was not a Republican official or candidate. Eric Von Hessler, who's a radio host, is now rumored to be going to run as a Libertarian for U.S. Senate. So maybe out of the biggest Tea Party event, the biggest thing that happens is the Libertarian Party gets stronger, and we've said this many times, as the Libertarian Party grows, the Republican Party shrinks. Scott, your thoughts on all this?
Well, I guess the best way to say it is a good friend is someone who has the same enemy as you do. And so to speak, if that's what came out of the Tea Party in Atlanta, you know, I'm all for it. Why don't they have another one and nominate Bob Barr again for president? It didn't hurt us to siphon off a few votes that way. But, you know, having said that, I can certainly tolerate a libertarian far better than I can a Republican in terms of how they see the world. So if the parties that we have to compete against in this state, in Georgia, you know, I'd much rather compete against a weakened Republican Party, but at the same time, keep in mind, if that Libertarian Party grows, it's going to siphon off a few Democrats here and there. So I don't want it to get too big, just enough to be a thorn in their side.
Oh, well, it will siphon off votes. And here's the thing, you know, Tom was talking about how the Georgia Senate race, you know, Isaacson may be in trouble. Well, if Isaacson, let's say he would get 50-52%, but a Libertarian candidate with a lot of juice like Von Hessler, who would be on the radio, could then siphon off 10%, and 8 or 9 of that came from Republicans, the other 1 or 2 came from Democrats, then even a, you know, not even a star candidate like, you know, say a Jim Marshall or a Hank Johnson, I'm just throwing out names, that I'm thinking, you know, the kind of folks that Tom Jensen may poll on, if those folks don't run, but then it's somebody that's, you know, further down the food chain, if you will, they could still push it into a runoff, and that's a lot of money the NRCC has to spend. I mean, the NRCC spent, what, $1 million or more on that runoff to protect Chambliss, and that put them in a weakened position, and that's now going to hurt them defending Richard Burr this time or going after Blanche Lincoln Lambert.
I'll be honest with you. I don't want to dispute the numbers that came across, but, you know, I had no idea Isaacson was that weak in this state. Certainly between the two candidates, you know, Chambliss and Isaacson, at least where I've come into contact with people, there is, you know, somewhat of more respect for Isaacson than Chambliss. And,
well,
you know, if those numbers are true, then we're going to need a strong libertarian to run play interference.
No, you know, Scott, you and Tom are both right. If you look at the public policy pollings, approval ratings for Sonny Perdue, for Johnny Isaacson, for Saxby Chambliss, Johnny Isaacson is the highest, but he's not that much higher. And just it's just Georgia's trending more Democratic. I mean, not, you know, in a huge way so, but enough that Georgia's become a battleground state in almost every race soon, and that's going to pose Isaacson a little more trouble than it would if he was in another state. So you're
well,
both right.
Let me ask you this. Is that true, or was it Barack Obama being at the top of the ticket in Georgia that drove what happened?
I think, obviously, Barack Obama made it move faster than it would have. Like I said, I've been reading that book by Chuck Todd of NBC, and it shows some really interesting thing. Like, if you look at just all women voters, you know, don't break it down by race, just all women voters, Barack Obama won, and also Jim Martin was right there. So, I mean, he did lift it up, but I think it's going to get to where Democrats compete in a lot of races, certainly enough that, you know, a strong third-party candidate can push this thing into a runoff, and the Republicans are going to have to consider rechanging those rules back to the old rules if it keeps on going like this, where, you know, you need to get 45.
And I want to get back with another question for you about what I was just talking about, the outrage here. And that was the overriding purpose of these Tea Parties. Didn't y'all see that those were anti-Obama rallies and that was what their anger was focused on?
Oh, I think it is. It's you know, we no longer have what we wanted. I'll tell you something I find kind of crazy in polling. Did y'all see the poll in USA Today and it said, you know, what do you think the best thing Obama did? What do you think the worst is? Or they actually asked about the dog in there. And there was, of course, I think 1 or 2% that said it's the best thing he had ever he's done is picking the dog, which that's just, you know, crazy. Obviously, you're so, you know, puffy and superficial. But then there was another 1 or 2% that said that's the worst thing he's done. Well, if you're such an Obama hater that you can pick out the worst thing he's done is picking out a certain breed of dog, you know, you need to really have some direction at what you're angry about. And I think that's where some of these Tea Party folks come in.
they're reaching for anything. I mean, they are in such a disarray right now, it's ridiculous. I mean, who is the head of the Republican Party? Because whoever it is, don't you dare mention a member of Congress. Because it's either the governor of Louisiana, it's either a national radio personality, or it's a governor in Alaska, but it's certainly not any member of Congress. And, you know, the whole tax or the Tea Parties, I mean, that's a riot. I mean, historically, why do we have the first Tea Parties?
Yeah, well, and there was some guy that was, you know, shouting, "No taxation without representation." But I was like, "Who took your vote away?"
You know what?
I think if you think about it,
they're right though, because if I go back and think of the first 6 years of the Bush administration, I think I had plenty of taxation, and I don't think there was a member in the Republican Congress who represented my interests. I just think they had their tax party after the fact. Because,
yeah.
I mean, you know, Tim was hitting the nail on the head. You want to talk about accountability. I mean, there has been absolutely no accountability within the Republican Party in terms of spending the taxpayers' dollars for at least the last previous 6 years or the first 6 years of the Bush administration. I mean, we were engaged in a two-front war, and it drove us into a recession. I mean, that's historically unheard of in the United States.
Yes.
Thank God they don't teach math.
Yes. Well, one thing we didn't get a chance to talk about this week, but we've talked about it on past weeks, and that would be, and Tim, you alluded to it, Texas. You know, they're wanting to become, some people in the state want to become their own country. And, of course, we saw the first poll that Rasmussen Reports did, but this week Daily Kos did a Research 2000 poll, and it showed that half of Republicans would like for Texas to become its own nation, whereas half Republicans want to stay. Now, of course, then if you look at all voters, Texas is in no danger of leaving America, because it shows that Democrats and independents want to stay part of America, and Democrats under a very overwhelming majority want to stay part of America. So it sounds like in Texas, Democrats are far more patriotic and loyal to America. I hope that point wasn't lost on anyone. But, Scott, we hadn't heard your take on this. What was your take on the Texas that, you know, some folks there may want to, you know, leave it instead of love it?
Well, you know, I put it to you this way. You were talking about earlier passing out the Kool-Aid. Apparently, our previous president got about 40% of the population there in Texas contaminated with the Kool-Aid. Because if they do break away, they've got a ready-made president right there to just drive them further into debt. So at least some of the folks in the Lone Star State are somewhat sober nowadays.
Yes, which I'll tell you this, though, if I was the Republican Party, like a Michael Steele, who's obviously not a Texas resident, I would be very worried, because you take away the state of Texas and all those votes, the Republicans have no chance at winning the popular vote ever again. Or I shouldn't say ever again. In the current political makeup, there's no way they get to anywhere near 50%.
Yeah, even more interesting in that polling was the fact, and I'm sure you noticed it, David, that the Senate race in every scenario is under 10 points, and it's an open race. That could get very interesting real fast.
Yeah, the mayor of Houston will be able to raise the money. There's some other candidates that Democrats like, Bill White being that mayor. But it's been a great show. It's been a great second anniversary show, starting our third year in full next week, when we'll have Steve Deke, a native of Virginia, is going to talk to us about the Virginia Senate race. He did clarify some things in an email today, one that I think Tom Jensen alluded to, is they don't have runoffs there. And also the shad planking was last week, and that's what Terry McAuliffe had all the signs out. And he said that's kind of common for that event, so it wasn't quite the the spectacle of it, you know, it appeared to be. I mean, it's the kind of thing where people do that to get a look, and then they take them all up. So I guess we were maybe a little on the outrage side. Since he's a native, he knew what was going on, and he said he was not necessarily a fan of Terry McAuliffe. He wasn't trying to defend him. He was just trying to explain what was going on there. But we're going to welcome him to really give an in-depth look. But, Scott, we've enjoyed having you on the Kudzu Vine, coming on again.
Pleasure was all mine. Thank you, gentlemen. I enjoyed it.
Yes. Well, until next week, see you, Tim.
Oh, yeah, David. It's been a great 2 years. Let's do it again next week.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.